regrets from Srimad Bhagavatam, from Srimad Bhagavad Gita rather, starting on page 1. And we'll start with the Prabhupada pranams also. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Dinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesha Sunyavani Paschacha Deshatarine Om Ajnana Timurandasya Jananjana Salakaya Chakshuram Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Karamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatam Gitam Tam Sajivam Sadvetam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Raghunatam Gitam Tam Sajivam Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Radhe Vrindavanishvare Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhyevacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare
Haribo.
So, good. Many of us here tonight, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, and Dilesh 10, so that's a good one. So let's have a look. We're looking at chapter 1. Which verse did we finish last time? Text 4. Okay, well let's start with text number 5. This is on page 40, yeah? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 Drishtaketush Chakitana
Kashirajascha
Viryavan Kashirajascha Viryavan Purujit Kunti Bhojas
Cha
Purujit Kunti Bhojas Cha Shaibhyas
Cha
Narapungavaha
Narapungavaha
Shaibhyas Cha Narapungavaha
Shaibhyas Cha Narapungavaha
Drishtaketus Chakitana
Kashirajascha Viryavan
Purujit Kunti Bhojascha
Shaibhyascha Narapungavaha
Drishtaketush Chakitana
Kashirajascha Viryavan
Purujit Kunti Bhojascha Shaibhyascha Narapungavaha.
Shaibhyascha Narapungavaha.
Drashta Ketus Chikitana.
Drishta Ketus Chikitana.
Kashi Rajascha Viryavan.
Kashi Rajascha Viryavan.
Purujit Kunti Bojascha.
Purujit Kunti Bojascha.
Saibhyascha Narapungavaha.
Shaibhyascha Narapungavaha.
Drishta Ketus Chikitana.
Drishta Ketus Chikitana.
Kashi Rajascha Viryavan.
Purujit Kunti
Bojascha.
Purujit Kunti Bojascha.
Shaibhyascha Narapungavaha.
Shaibhyascha Narapungavaha. Anyone else? Anishi?
Drishta Ketus Chikitana.
Kashi Rajascha Viryavan.
Purujit Kunti
Bojascha.
Saibhyascha Narapungavaha.
Drishta Ketu.
Drishta Ketu.
Chikitana.
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 Kashi Raja.
Kashi Raja.
Kashi Raja.
Kashi
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Viryavan.
Viryavan.
Very powerful.
Very powerful.
Purujit.
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 Kunti Bhoja.
Kunti Bhoja.
Kunti Bhoja.
Cha.
Cha. And.
Shaibhya.
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 Cha.
Cha.
And.
And.
Narapungavaha.
Narapungavaha.
Hero in human society.
Hero in human society.
Translation. There are also great heroic powerful fighters like Drishtaketu, Chikitana, Kashiraj, Purujit, Kuntibhoj and Shaibhya. So please repeat. There are also great heroic powerful fighters.
There are also great heroic powerful fighters.
Like Drishtaketu.
Like Drishtaketu.
Chikitana.
Chikitana.
Kashiraja.
Kashiraja.
Purujit.
Purujit.
Kuntibhoja.
Kuntibhoja.
And Shaibhya.
And Shaibhya. Hmm.
So there's no purport, but here what we're observing is the situation that we see in text 3, Duryodhan is addressing his illustrious teacher, Dronacharya, and requesting him to please behold the great army of the sons of Pandu, so expertly arranged by your intelligent disciple, the son of Draupada. So this is Drishtajumna. And he's saying, here in this army are many heroic bowmen, equal in fighting to Bhima and Arjuna. Great fighters like Yuyudhan, Virata and Drupada. There are also great heroic powerful fighters like Drishtaketu, Chikitana, Kashiraj, Purujit, Kuntibhoja and Shaibhya. So there are no purports for the next two verses. So let's read these through just with the English. There are the mighty Yudhamanyu, the very powerful Uttamoja, the son of Subhadra, and the sons of Draupadi. All these warriors are great chariot fighters. But for your information, O best of the Brahmanas, let me tell you about the captains who are especially qualified to lead my military force. So, this situation is all about observing. This chapter is called Observing the Armies on the Battlefield of Kurukshetra. And as we're seeing, Duryodhan is very keen to observe what is the situation and bring it to the attention of his Gurudev. Because actually, he is interested in military progression. And so the Kshatriyas, they've got a military teacher. And of course, Krishna as we'll see in Bhagavad Gita, he becomes actually the guru for the supreme subject matter, for Arjuna. Arjuna is also a disciple of Duryodhana. And of course, before the battle, Arjuna and the Pandavas, they're all coming and saluting their spiritual masters, the great warriors, Bhishma Dev, Dronacharya, as great illustrious persons. And in this way, although they're going to fight on opposite sides, they're actually offering proper respects before they begin their dharma, which is actually to seriously get into fighting to the death. They're ready to lay down their lives. It's that serious. It's not some fancy footwork. It's actually a fight to the death, because this is the Kshatriya's business, to fight. And if he comes back from the from the battlefield not victorious, then at least he should be injured, if not killed. This is the Kshatriya's role, to take his fighting duty very seriously. And they're described in this verse as great, heroic, and powerful. Yeah. So they're ready for a serious fight. So also we see Subhadra, the son of Subhadra, who is the son of Subhadra. In text 6 we see Subhadra, which means the son of Subhadra. He's a very powerful fighter. We'll see how on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, although he was only a young lad, actually only 16 years old, he was a very... Abhimanyu, yes, Abhimanyu. He was, yes, Subhadra means the son of Subhadra, that is his name, Abhimanyu. He was only 16 years old, but such a powerful fighter that Bhishma, Karna, Drona, and two others, also great Maharathis, they had to surround him and not let him out in order to kill him. So it was a very unfair fight. After all, a 16-year-old boy and five greatest generals on the side of the Kauravas, they had to actually gang up on him in order to defeat him. So it's also described that you see the wonderful nature of not only the heroic fighters, that they could stand and hold their ground in very adverse situations, but also we see how that in warfare it gets pretty ugly, which is why it is a good idea to avoid warfare if it can be done. But sometimes, as we see, it's necessary to get into a serious fight. And we see that in the history of the world, especially the history of the Kali Yuga, it's very prominently punctuated in all our history lessons by this battle and that war and this person trying to take over. You know, over a short period of history, over the few hundred years that are covered in our history books, the punctuation marks are this battle of Hastings or wherever it were, or the European wars, battles in America. These are what actually punctuated the decision-making processes ultimately when people can't sort out their differences in a peaceful way. So everything was tried to peacefully resolve the situation. Krishna tried to arrange nice facilities. But when you've ultimately got belligerent parties, if they cannot see sense, then ultimately, when push comes to shove, it's put up your dukes and, you know, we'll sort it out on the battlefield. Nowadays, of course, many people want to do this thing where they settle, I'll see you in court. But this has also become a situation of fighting. In England and in the West, we have what's called the adversarial system. Again, it's a fighting business, but you get the solicitors, the barristers, to do the fighting for you. And you come out, any warfare is expensive. Even in the courtroom, fighting is very expensive. They call the legal profession the second oldest profession. the oldest profession, of course, being prostitution. And the second oldest profession in the legal profession mean that they're going to fleece you for all your money. So this is actually the business. And to fight in a battle is also a very expensive affair. Because you'll have to pay so many soldiers. You're going to have to equip everyone with so many weaponry. It's not a new thing. Nowadays, of course, the leaders, they adopt a rather different tactic. They send the untrained men, men who are trained, who are brought up as Shudras and not trained from childhood to be warriors and martially spirited men, out to fight their battles. And the leaders of society bravely stay behind and give the orders. You do it like this, like that. So it is a very sad state of affairs. But here you see in this battle, even the great generals, even Bhishma Dev, very old man, but still quite prepared to go out on the battlefield himself and fight, taking all risks, even at the later stage of life. So, very extraordinary atmosphere in this battlefield situation. But we also see there are other extraordinary qualities apart from the fighting qualities. Just like Subhadra, who is, after all, Krishna's sister. Although her son was killed, practically in the presence of Krishna, still she did not protest or lose her love for Krishna in any way, that her son, Abhimanyu, had been killed on the battlefield in this way. That was the business. Fighting business has to go on. When there is a fight, people get hurt, people get killed, people die. That's the way of it. And 640 million people all had to lose their lives. But they're all very fortunate persons. Because they died in the presence of Lord Krishna, they all gained Sarupya Mukti. So there was no difficulty for them. In fact, it was to everyone's benefit that they died in that situation. It was actually a very good thing. And Krishna explained just before the battlefield, further on in this text, where they're all getting ready to get into it seriously, that Krishna explains to Arjun that actually, but for you, the Pandavas, everyone here will be killed. And actually, the situation is that, my dear Arjun, you must act as a matter of duty. And this, we can see, is how the Kshatriyas were acting as a matter of duty. And we learn from Bhagavad Gita about, in our own lives, how to act as a matter of duty. And particularly, we learn from Bhagavad Gita that there are different levels of duties to be performed. But also we learn especially that there is the topmost duty, and that is to actually advance in spiritual life. We learn from Arjuna that actually one has to address the real problems of life. One has to make inquiries about what are the real problems of life. And then, having established what the real problems of life are, try to understand how to address them, how to deal with those problems once we've understood what they are. But generally speaking, in this age, we find that people have no idea what the problems of life actually are, neither they have any inclination to even inquire about their own eternal existence, about their spiritual existence. People are very much inclined to think that actually the real problems are how to get the latest electronic gadget, how to get through the day, how to keep a good job, how to get a nice house, and how to keep the family together. These are considered the really success stories of life, if you can just do these things. But here we see Arjun is very concerned, because he's actually on a higher level of understanding, and he's going to be asking Krishna, but wait a minute, Krishna, because I shouldn't really be fighting, because in the course of this fight, so many families are going to be destroyed. The family tradition will be destroyed. So that goes, obviously, in this current day and age, everyone's seeing that without even trying, just by living in the West, everyone's seeing their family traditions destroyed. Is it not? Just by living in the West, the family traditions going up in smoke. So that argument goes out the window. That's no reason to do what Krishna says. But so many other arguments, Krishna's being asked by Arjuna, that actually I'll be responsible for killing all these people. And in fact, at the end of the battlefield, when Yudhisthira, even after the battle has been fought, and all these 640 million have been killed, Yudhisthira, he's thinking himself culpable. He's thinking himself guilty of having slaughtered all these people. And even after this huge big battle arrangement, he's thinking, now the battle has been fought and everyone's been killed, I can't take up the throne even now. Just see the moral dilemma of all these Vaishnavas. Arjuna is in a great dilemma beforehand as to fight, and even after everyone's been killed and everyone's lost their lives, still Yudhisthira is in this dilemma. I can't take up the throne because, after all, I'm responsible for all the sons, husbands, fathers being killed. Actually, I'm going to take all their sinful reactions. He can't understand what to do. So for the great fighters and leaders in society, they are all of them in the situation, as we all are, where we need to take higher instruction. Before the battlefield, Arjuna was trying to take good instruction from Krishna. And he's saying, my dear Krishna, but for you, no one else can be found who can instruct me. Nobody else can drive away this grief. No one else is fit to be my guru. And at the end, Yudhisthira Maharaj, he is very concerned to understand what to do. And he tries to take all good instruction, and various people try and give him good instruction. Vyasadeva tries to advise Yudhisthira Maharaj. The great sages, they all come and try to advise him. And Krishna also tries to advise Yudhisthira Maharaj. And no one can convince him to take up the throne, except one great personality. Because in spite of all the whole battlefield politics and arrangements, still, Krishna, he knows who his devotees are. And he gives the glory of the being able to convince Yudhisthira. He gives that glory to
Bhishmadev,
who's lying on a bed of arrows, who has the great benediction that he cannot be killed by anyone. Although he admits, he says actually, although he's lying on a bed of arrows, he says that the one that really got me, that was Arjuna's arrow. And so he's lying on a bed of arrows. And there, he's giving instruction to Yudhisthira Maharaj. Just see the qualities of these personalities. And he's not dying, because he's got this benediction that I'll only die when I want to die. So very extraordinary personalities. So we're seeing a culture of extraordinary personalities. So we shouldn't take any of these personalities as being just ordinary fellows like you and me. They're actually all extraordinary personalities. And particularly, what extraordinary personalities talk about is an extraordinary subject matter. And the most extraordinary subject matter, of course, we see the whole Mahabharata is full of the most extraordinary history of the universe. But the most extraordinary part and the most valuable part that we can get is from this conversation in little part of the Mahabharata known as the Bhagavad Gita. This is where you get the really, really juicy, important instruction about what is best, what is to be done, what is the really significant point. Because out of all the great, great conversations and events and activities going on by all these great persons, the most important part is this conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Why? Because Krishna's position, as will be revealed in Bhagavad Gita, is way beyond those of any other living entity on the battlefield or in the whole Mahabharata. It's because Krishna is declared by the great sages, by the author of the Mahabharata, Vyasadeva, by all the great sages, Narada Muni, Asita, Devala, by himself, by Arjuna, by the Pandavas, to be Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram Paramam Bhavan, the Supreme Brahman. So people are in, there are different classes of transcendentalists. There are those who are Brahmanandis. They want to experience the Brahman effulgence. They want to merge with God. They want to experience their relationship with the Supreme, becoming one with God. And there are those who are actually more advanced on the personal conception of God, those who are yogis. They're interested in meditating on the Paramatma, and by their yoga practice, their interest, however, is actually to acquire some yoga siddhi, to become very expert, to be able to do all these wonderful yogic things. But there are those who are the Vaishnavas, who are way beyond the Brahmanandis and the yogis. Their interest is actually on the source of the Paramatma, which Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita is but a tiny portion of himself. He says, no, Arjuna, because the Paramatma is present not only in everyone's heart, but in every atom pervading the entire universe. And Krishna explains to Arjuna, he says, no, Arjuna, that with only a single fragment of myself, I pervade and maintain this entire universe. There is Krishna. He's walking and discussing on everything in the pastimes that he performs on the earth. But with a tiny portion of himself, he's eternally pervading and maintaining the entire universe. And yet he retains his own supreme position as the original personality of Godhead. And as far as the impersonal Brahman, Krishna explains that this Brahman, Brahmanohi Pratishtaham, he says, I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman. Sutre Maniganaiva. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. So Krishna is declaring his supreme position. And in Bhagavatam, if we go a little further, we find that the three aspects of the Absolute Truth are very nicely described. Vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajjnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti sabjite. That this non-dual substance, because we're talking about the same substance, which is both Brahman and Paramatma and Bhagavan, is the same non-dual substance. It's understood by learned transcendentalists in three phases, both Brahman and Paramatma and Bhagavan. But those who only know the Brahman feature of Krishna, their understanding is very crippled, is very limited. They have very little understanding of what is God. They do not differentiate between the different qualities of God. They prefer to take the explanations which are given in the Upanishads that God is niraka and nirguna. He has no qualities, he has no activities. Certainly, just like you see the light coming through the window from the sunshine, this has no particular qualities or activities. But yet you see that its source, the sun, is very potent. This energy, this Brahman energy, which is the basis of everything. Just like we understand from our science classes that everything is made of energy, yes? That ultimately, you know, they split the atom and they find out there's an incredible amount of energy inside every tiny atom, yes? And that energy is what makes up the atomic structure and the molecular structure, and those molecules make the different forms that we see manifest in this world. But that energy, where is that energy coming from? Whose energy is it? It's Krishna's energy. Just like the sun. The sun's energy is not existing independently. It belongs to the sun. The sun is manifesting it. So similarly, Krishna is manifesting his unlimited varieties, which comprise both the spiritual world and the material world. Krishna's energies are manifesting the unlimited Paraprakriti, the spiritual world, and also the Aparaprakriti, the material world. The material world is very different from the spiritual world because here we see everything has a lifespan. The wrinkles are there. The lifespan is there. You know, we're getting old. the young children that we once were scampering around, those are finished. Under the influence of time, everything is very firmly controlled. We want to say, I'm killing time. But no, time is killing us. Actually, this is how it's working. So everything is under the control of time. And Krishna says, that time I am, the destroyer of these worlds, and I'm come to engage all men. So everything is working. Krishna's different energies are working. And both Krishna's Brahman energy is working under the direction of Krishna, and his Paramatma feature, he is known as the overseer, the permitter. Just like Krishna is seated in everyone's heart. We were reading this, I think, the other day. The verse was about how Krishna is the overseer and the permitter. Yes, was it here we were reading this? Okay. Well, in chapter 13, we find this verse where Krishna explains that he's the overseer and the permitter. Just like we all have experience as children. If you wanted to go to the bathroom, you have to ask your mother. You ask your mother, can I go to the bathroom? You ask permission. It is a very natural thing. Because actually, we're all being permitted to act in this material world. We want to act in a particular way. And the Lord gives us a particular body so that we can act in different ways. So all the features of the Lord, this permission is given by the super soul within the heart, who is also within every atom. Now you may think, I can make matter work in the way I want it to work. But have you ever had the experience of having an electronic gadget like a telephone or a TV camera or a TV or a video player that doesn't work the way you want it to work? Anyone's had that experience? Yeah. That it just doesn't quite work the way you want it to work, and it sometimes it just doesn't work. Because things, not only we are making imperfect things, but things are not working under our control. But they're working under the control of Krishna. So we may propose something. We may say, my dear Lord, I would like this to happen. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen. If Krishna permits, it will happen. And if Krishna doesn't permit, it won't happen. So therefore, it is actually a very good idea, even from any level, to start to address the person under whose control things actually are happening. If we want to actually execute our activities nicely in life, we may say, yes, I would like to do this, I would like to do that. So we can take permission. Yes. We can ask Krishna and see if it's a good idea or not. This is part of Krishna consciousness. Seeing in the light of guidance from Lord Krishna and the spiritual master is what I want to do a very good idea. Just like I may ask, well, I see that my next door neighbor is giving me trouble. He keeps parking in front of my driveway. My dear Lord, can I have permission to kill him? No. That is not a good idea. One should take one's permission from the higher authority. The higher authority is ultimately the representative of Krishna. Because Krishna is the supreme authority. And so if we want to do something, we can check with Krishna first of all. Is it a good idea if I do this? What do you think? So this is Krishna consciousness. We ask Krishna, should I do this or should I not do this? And Arjuna, he's also checking with Krishna to see what to do. He's in a dilemma. He needs advice. He needs guidance. So this is going on. Now what I want to do is, I'm aware that we have limitations on our time, but before I go on to speak about the other things I want to talk about this evening, because it is today the appearance day of a very wonderful saintly person who we can learn many, many things about. That is Sripad Ramanujacharya. I just wondered if anyone's got any questions or comments they'd like to ask about what we've talked about or what we're reading as individuals in Bhagavad Gita. Are there any questions anyone would like to raise? Or any comments?
You know, we mentioned about devotees, they get a sarupya impression.
They get a spiritual body.
Yeah.
In the spiritual world.
Meaning they don't come back at all.
That's right. It's a good idea.
That's not the devotees who wouldn't wish that for that.
Well, the devotees, yeah, they would be happy to go back to the spiritual sky if it means they can engage in serving Krishna. The pure devotees, their interest is to serve Krishna. But if they're going to go somewhere where they can't serve Krishna, then they're not interested. Whatever kind of, and especially the Sayujya liberation, means to merge with the impersonal feature of God. This they definitely don't want to know about. Because that kind of liberation means you don't have any individuality. You don't have any way of expressing your service. You don't have any way of practically engaging in the loving service to God. If you've extinguished your personality, just like now, you've got a mind, you've got senses, you've got limbs, you can render different services to Krishna. But if all this is disappeared and you've merged with the impersonal feature of God, what are you going to do to serve Him? Therefore, it's not accepted by the Vaishnavas, by the pure devotees. They don't want to know about this. They reject it. Even if you offered me this, my Lord, I'll not accept it. I only want your devotional service. Mama janmani janmanishvare bhavatad bhakti rahituki tai. I only want your causeless devotional service in my life, birth after birth. So this is the Vaishnava's attitude. Is it okay? Any other questions or comments? Kiran Prabhu, you have any nice questions for us?
Just one thought. I mean, these great warriors, some of them are known by the mothers and not the fathers. Originally, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but originally I thought that, you know, they were given respect to the mother rather than the father, you know, in those days.
Sometimes nice. Both. Krishna, he is known as Devaki Nandan, and he's also.
What is changing now? I thought when he mentioned Subhadra and the son of Subhadra and the son of Draupadi, so you couldn't say the son of Arjun, because is it Abhimanyu or is it the son of Subhadra who they refer to? Is it the son of Draupadi that they refer to, because he fathered both of them? So I assume, because they married, you know, two or three women, they always have to refer to the son of their mother as opposed to their father, who would be one.
Not always necessarily. It doesn't always follow like that. Just like, for example, Krishna's prominent children, Prajumna, Aniruddha, these different sons and grandsons, Shamba, their names don't necessarily get associated immediately with their mothers, but their names do get associated with Krishna. So the simple answer I can give is it depends. But I can't give you what it depends upon.
I just thought there might be some confusion, you know, when somebody asks, oh, well, my son is doing this and this, somebody will say, well, I'm a big son.
Well, obviously,
my son, you know, the son of Subhadra is this, or my son of Draupadi is doing this. I'm just sort of just throwing this thing in the air.
Okay.
And this other thing you said, 640 million people are
finding
it difficult to picture.
Why is it difficult?
Just the sheer number of people that's there on the ground. You know,
millions
we're talking about, and that's just difficult to picture on its own.
Difficult. Can you picture what Sanjay is picturing? He is able to observe in minute detail, even though he's not on the battlefield. 5,000 years ago, he's picturing in great, much better than technicolor detail, everything that's going on. Wherever he wants to look on the battlefield by his mystic power, he's seeing the picture. And not just the picture, but the sound is getting the full audio-visual experience of what's happening with the driving of the chariot in between the two armies, seeing the different conversations going on both sides of the battlefield, seeing them all and listening to them all, blowing their conch shells, and seeing their hairs standing on end, You know, he's seeing in great detail everything that's going on. But whether we may find it difficult to picture, certainly we can understand that this is from a culture which is very different from ours. And if we try to put things into the perspective of seeing also how Krishna was not coming to kill off a few people who were demons, but the Bhagavatam explains that at the time the whole world was overburdened with the military might of the demoniac forces. Just like you see that Jarasandha, when he came to attack Krishna, he had 13 divisions of soldiers, many hundreds and thousands of soldiers, and cavalry and infantry and elephants and chariots, just for one king. And here you see all these great kings and they've amassed massive armies. And it's for this reason that Krishna is coming to cleanse the earth of all these things. And Krishna himself, you may say, well, it's very difficult to picture that Krishna could have, okay, maybe he could have 8 wives, but 16,108 wives, 16,108 palaces. It may be beyond our comprehension to understand these things, how they're actually taking place. But these things are not subject to our ability to understand. But rather, if we can try and develop our ability to understand, then we can profit from the narration given by Vyasadeva in the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, and the Srimad Bhagavatam, that it's not in the least bit exaggeration, but it's a statement of fact, far more factual, far more authoritative than the so-called history books which we're brought up with in our current school, which are based on 95% speculation. But these are actually based on factual experience and factually observing the situation, and that information being passed down through an unbroken chain of disciplic succession, rather than a few artifacts and books being dug up by people and them guessing and trying to piece together and write a history of a tiny portion of Europe or or whatever, which is how we get our current modern day history lessons. These history lessons are coming down by disciplic succession. And the Puranas means the histories, the Itihasas also. These literatures, they give us descriptions about the significant events, not only that happened on this planet, but significant events that have happened throughout the history of the universe. And most significant, meaning those events which are related to the Lord and his different incarnations, the different incarnations of the personality of Godhead. So you may find it hard to imagine even some ordinary everyday thing. But you see that if you go to the hospital and you ask the doctors, and you ask them, well, you, my dear sir, my dear madam, you've got very good medicinal knowledge and experimentation and so many things, but it's very unfortunate that in spite of all your advancement of knowledge, that actually you still cannot understand what is the source of energy that keeps giving the heart the facility to keep pumping and pumping and pumping. And when that source of energy has somehow disappeared, then the heart just stops pumping. So for our modern everyday experience, we are trying to come up with so many answers and put the world into perspective. But there are things which are beyond the perspective even of our best so-called knowledgeable persons, even in this material world. Our modern technology may give us some ideas about what's going on. I mean, you see that even in these genocidal wars in Africa and places, and Europe, you see sometimes millions of people are being killed. But here we see a time when military armies around the earth were being cultivated like anything. And we see that for the Battle of Kurukshetra, armies were brought, personalities came from all over the whole planet to fight this war. So it was a very serious war, because Hastinapur was the seat of the emperor of the whole world. So this was literally a world war. This wasn't like our puny so-called world wars. This was seriously a world war, and the armies from everywhere were being brought in to fight it out on the plains of Kurukshetra.
So how come Krishna gave his army to Duryodhana when he knew that he was on the wrong side?
Krishna didn't want to fight personally because it was a family quarrel. So he didn't want to get involved in a family quarrel.
But his army was in the support of Duryodhana, wasn't it?
Yes. So Krishna's army, they also were part of the military might. In the Bhagavatam, we get a very nice example of how the Yadu dynasty, for example, their army, they're very powerful warriors. But Krishna employed the Yadu dynasty, which were actually so many demigods, called down to earth to assist Krishna in his pastimes. And they were the, just like the idea is, suppose if you've ever been walking out in the village, if you've been walking around Govardhan Hill, you may have sometimes noticed they have very big thorns, which are very long and sharp, and if you get one stuck inside your foot or your leg, it's a very painful affair. But it's a very long, slender thing. Now, you may have noticed that as you were a child in England, I know this would happen with me, that if I got a splinter in my finger, then my mother, she would get a needle and try and prise out the splinter. So the principle is that if you're out wandering around Govardhan Hill, you may not happen to have access to a sterile needle. So what else have you got that's very sharp and long and thin and strong? Is another thorn. So you use a thorn to take out the thorn. So Krishna also employed his own military strength to also annihilate the military strength that was built up on the earth. So if you've got a lot of military might and main, then there comes a time when, just as we see with the Yadu dynasty, they became very strong and very belligerent. And you know, if you find you've got a whole bunch of military men and they don't have anything particularly to do, then you've got a problem on your hands if you've got no engagement for them. So if that military might is also wiped out in the process, it's not a problem. So Krishna, he brought his army in, which he utilized on many occasions. And sometimes you see even that when Krishna brought his army in, still he defended his whole army himself single-handedly. Like when he was fighting with Jarasandha, so that his own army didn't even experience even a scratch. Krishna killed the opposing forces of Jarasandha himself. But on this case, it appeared that Krishna wanted to dispose of a lot of the military might of the earth. And Krishna, he also wanted to be seen to be very fair. So he was very fair. No one can say he wasn't fair to the Kauravas. He gave his whole army to the Kauravas. He said, I'm not going to fight. And so the person who, one of you, Duryodhan or Arjun, you can have my army, and the other one I'll be on your side, but I won't fight. So how fair can you be to the other side if you give your whole army? And more than fair. And at the same time, Krishna said, but I will, my dear Arjun, I'll drive your chariot, but I won't fight. So this is Krishna's renunciation. But even he'd given his whole army, even the Pandavas were incredibly military, outnumbered. Still, they had Krishna on their side, so they were guaranteed victory. But it wasn't that Krishna didn't give them a sporting chance. Is that okay? Okay. So, while we have a chance, I'd like to talk something about Sripad Ramanujacharya, if I may, with your permission. Is it okay? Ramanujacharya, he appeared 12 years short of 1,000 years ago, actually, 1017 AD. And he is a very wonderful child. he was given the name because of his beautiful effulgence. He was given a name of Lakshman, Ramanuja, actually, is another name of Lakshman. And Anuja, Ram Anuja, follower of Ram, like that. So, Ramanuja, he was, from his very childhood, very extraordinary and gifted. And there are many incidents that we can learn about his glorious activities which we can profit from in our everyday lives. One thing we can learn is that he actually is a great contributor to the philosophy of all the Vaishnavas around the planet. He's particularly noted for having appeared in the Sri Sampradaya with a very wonderful spiritual master himself. Anyone know his spiritual master's name? Almost gave it away.
Yamunacharya,
yes. Who was also known as the King Alavandar. Jamuna, his spiritual master, even as a 12-year-old boy, was a very powerful personality. I think if I start by talking about his spiritual master, it might be a good place to say that even as a 12-year-old child, his Guru Dev had been defeated in an argument by one great court pundit of royal patronage. He was the king's favorite pundit. And the king had made a declaration that anyone who is defeated by this pundit, I'm just trying to remember his name. Can anyone remember the name of this pundit? Anyway, they said that he must pay taxes to this pundit or die. So the disciples of this great pundit came round to see little Jamuna. He was only 12 years old. He came round to see his guru and demanded that your guru has been defeated by our great pundit, and therefore he must pay taxes. He hasn't paid his taxes now for several years, so now he must pay his taxes or he must die. So Jamuna, this little boy, he said, well, actually, I think that your great pundit is actually nothing but a great fool. You know, very brazen. Although the king had given his order like this, that anyone who doesn't pay has to be killed. And he says, the reason I say that your guru is a great fool is because if he has disciples like you who show no respect for great personalities and who simply are full of pride and insult others, and if this is the training he has given you, then he must also be a great fool. So, I'll tell you what, I'll challenge your guru to a debate and defeat him. So this was taken by the servants of the guru, the great pundit, to be a great shock. You know, how could this little boy say anything? But actually they couldn't even answer his question. But they took his comments back to the king, back to the court, and told this great conquering pundit that this is the situation. So the pundit, he was laughing. He thought, a 12-year-old boy is challenging me. And he was laughing about it. And the king was, he was also laughing about it because he was very proud of the royal pundit like that. So he, but still, a challenge was a challenge. So they sent a letter back to Jamuna to say, all right, we accept the challenge. So you should come to the royal court and we'll have a debate. So Jamuna, he sent a letter back. Good, I'm glad you've accepted the challenge. Now, because this is a very serious affair, you should send the royal palanquin and armed guards and a whole procession with Brahmins to chant mantras and escort me to the royal palace and we will have the proper debate. You know, here's this 12-year-old boy just demanding like this. So the king had to accept, yes, all right. He did that. And so Jimuna came into the royal court, and they had this big discussion. And this big expert pundit, he was asking Jimuna question after question after question. And Jimuna was very easily defeating all this big pundit's arguments. And he was saying, why didn't you, and all the time, the pundit, he was trying to think of more and more and more difficult questions. And Jimuna asked him, said, why are you just asking me all the easy questions? Is it because I'm a little boy? If size is anything to do with the learning of a person, then the water buffalo must be a much bigger pundit than you. So this great royal patronage pundit, he was for the first time practically speechless. So we said, all right, well, why don't you ask the questions then? So Jimuna said, all right, I have three propositions and you must defeat them. So this was very interesting discussion going on, and the three questions, he accepted it, and these are the three propositions that little Jimuna put to the big pundit. He said, first, I put the proposition to you that your mother is not a barren woman. And what could the Digvijaya say? Because if his mother was not a barren woman, then how could he exist? So he couldn't say anything. He said, all right, then I give you my second proposition. My second proposition is that the king, and you must defeat this, that this king is a supremely righteous man and is filled with piety and religion. Now he's right there in the royal court and he's being asked to defeat this proposition in front of the king, that the king is a supremely pious and religious man. So still he couldn't say anything. So Jimuna said, all right, then I give you my third proposition. My third proposition that you must defeat is that the queen is chaste and faithful to her husband, just like Savitri. And the queen is also there. So, and she's thinking this is great, because she actually, she really wanted this pundit to be finished. And actually there was a wager that the king and the queen made to each other. And she actually made a wager with the king that I think that this young boy, he will defeat this pundit. And if he doesn't defeat, then I will become the servant of the maidservant of your maidservants. This was the queen's wager. And the king, he said, all right, to counter that wager, I give the wager that if he does defeat the royal pundit, then I will give him half of my kingdom. So it was a really serious affair. So after hearing this last point about defeating, how the queen was the most chaste and faithful to her husband, this pundit, he just exploded and he said, how can you speak such foolish things? You should be killed immediately for making such nonsensical presentations. But there were many Brahmins in the audience and they had all been defeated by this pundit and they were all cheering on Jimuna and saying, yeah, we want him defeated, we want him down, he's finished. So anyway, there was a big fight broke out in the audience and Jimuna said, stop, I will now defeat my own propositions. Because the pundit demanded it. He said, you cannot defeat them. And the Brahmins were all saying, no, that wasn't part of the deal. The deal was that you're the big pundit, you should be able to defeat anything he says. So they were saying, you don't have to. But Jimuna said, no, I will defeat my own three propositions. And this little boy, Jimuna, he described that actually, according to the Manu Samhita, a woman who has only one son is considered a barren woman. And therefore, because you, O great pundit, are the only son of your father, therefore your mother is considered a barren woman. Point number one. Point number two, the king is a supremely righteous man and is filled with piety and religion. So again, Jimuna, he quoted the Manu Samhita. He said, although the king is without doubt a most glorious and munificent and merciful and learned person and very pious and righteous king, still it is a fact that the king, he has to accept 1/6 of the pious reactions of his subjects and also 1/6 of the sinful reactions of his subjects. And because now we are living in the Kali Yuga, therefore so many of his subjects are sinful persons, therefore actually he has to accept all these sinful activities. Therefore, in that sense, he is not a pious man. Second point. Then the third point, that the queen is chaste and faithful to her husband, just like Savitri. So then this little Jamuna, he's pointing out, actually the queen, she is the embodiment of all virtues, as everyone knows. She's supremely virtuous and chaste and serves only her husband. Therefore, she is the embodiment of chastity. But again in the Manu Samhita, it is stated that the king is the representative of all the principal demigods. And actually, in that way, the queen has 7 different husbands. The Vayu, Chandra, Indra, Shiva, like that, these different demigods. So in this way, how you can say that she is chaste, because she's serving 7 different husbands. So in this way, there was such an uproar that Jamunacharya, little Jamuna, he was declared by the king to be a very, very great pundit. And then when it came to the shove, then Jamuna, he was given half the kingdom by the king. And although he was only a 12-year-old boy, he became the ruler of a great kingdom. And he became very much involved for many years, but he was very sharp. And although so many invading kings would come and try and attack him because they'd heard only this 12-year-old boy is the king, so now we can easily attack him and bump him off and we can expand our kingdoms. But very quickly, Jamuna learnt the military arts, and he was not only repelling them, but he was sending out his armies to expand his kingdom. And he became a very great king. He became known as Alavandar. And it so happened that after some time, that his grandfather wanted very much that Jamuna return to his studies. Because he became so absorbed in kingly duties that he forgot all about his childhood life, how he'd been a great pundit under the mercy of his Gurudev. So he sent this Ramdas, his grandfather sent Ramdas, who made a very nice plan. And he brought this very special spinach. And he brought it to the king's cook and said, I don't making any charge for this, but I want you to make this special dish for the king every day. Please make this because it will give the king great vitality and great strength and it will please him very much. So he never made any charge for it, which is quite unusual, but he had a real plan in mind. And when the cook would make this for Alavanda, the king, then he would enjoy it so much. And after 3 days, he was bringing this every day. Everybody else would charge a fortune for it, for whatever they brought to the royal palace. But Ramdas was making no charge whatsoever. And then after 3 days, he stopped bringing the spinach. And Alavanda was really shocked. And he asked the cook, where's the spinach? This is my favorite dish. It's such a good dish. What happened to it? He said, well, actually, there's one man who used to bring it every day out of great love and affection. He's come and bringing this out of great love for you, my dear king. He's bringing this to make you very happy and satisfied, but he has not come today. So King Alavanda said, I want to meet this man. Let me meet him. So he arranged the meeting, and Ramdas, in this way, he got to meet Alavanda the king. And he said, actually, my dear king, I am actually a representative of your grandfather. And your grandfather has a very great treasure for you. And this treasure is so important, but it is very much just for you alone. So Alavanda, he was busy fighting political campaigns and wars, and great wealth was a really important thing for him at that time. So he thought, this is very good. So Ramdas sent away all the cooks and all the soldiers, and he said, look, I want to tell you about this treasure, but it's guarded on all different sides. It's only approached by some mantra. It's guarded by different snakes. It's in a very dangerous place, and it's only accessible by very great difficulty. But I know the secret, and I want to take you there. So Alavandar agreed. He said, all right, let's go. So they went, and they were traveling for many days. And every day at lunchtime, Ramdas, he would recite the entire Bhagavad Gita. And Jamuna, Alavandar, he would hear this, because this was some years on his campaign. You can understand that in kingly duties, you forget about the rest of the world. You're just really involved in kingly life. So every day on their journey, hearing this Bhagavad Gita, his taste for Bhagavad Gita started to awaken. And then Ramdas, he started explaining to him, from the words of his Gurudev, the instructions and explanations about the text of Bhagavad Gita. And Alavandar started becoming awakened to his understanding. He said, I've not heard nectar like this since I was a little boy. I'm feeling very happy about this. And he became so enlivened and enlightened by the words of Ramdas, his original consciousness started awakening. And in this way, Ramdas convinced him. He said, actually, why don't we forget about all this gold? Why don't you forget about your kingdom? This is actually the treasure that your grandfather wanted you to have. So he said, now let us just give up this thought of fighting royal wars and get into the real treasure of life. And Alavandar completely agreed, and he became completely fixed up in devotional service, and he became known as the great Jamunacharya, the leading light of the entire Sri Sampradaya. So he is the spiritual master of Sri Ramanujacharya. And Ramanujacharya himself, he had a very powerful spiritual master. But there was one problem with his spiritual master, whose name was Yadava Prakash, that his spiritual master was a great Mayavadi. Mayavadi means he is follower of the Shankara impersonal Mayavad school, which considers that ultimately the living entities and God are one, the same person, or the same being, and there is no individual distinction. So there were times when, although Ramanuja as a young boy, he displayed the most wonderful qualities and characteristics of an excellent disciple. He was so willing to learn. He would learn all his lessons by the end of the day, and he would become expert in the subject. He was always very willing and submissive and eager to serve the spiritual master and serve the other disciples. Such a first-class disciple. But there were times when there were descriptions about the Supreme Absolute Truth that Ramanuja could not go along with. For example, one very famous time when after the morning class, then Yadava Prakash requested Ramanuja to please give him a massage with scented oils. So this is the natural business of the disciple, to serve the spiritual master. So during the course of the massage, one of the other students came in and started asking Yadava Prakash about a verse from the Bhagavatam. And Yadava Prakash started explaining this verse. And in his explanation he gave, he described how Vishnu has reddish eyes like the backside of a monkey, and so many other different descriptions. And when Ramanuja heard this, he could not contain himself. And he started crying hot tears of anger and distress. And while he was massaging Yadava Prakash, the tears were falling from his eyes on his guru's body. And his guru looked up with a start. What's this? What is the problem? What have I said that is wrong? And Ramanuja explained, actually, you have completely misexplained this verse. This is the disciple telling the guru that you have completely misexplained this verse. And then Yadava Prakash, he was quite offended, and he said, well, let us hear your explanation then. Let us see if you've got a better explanation than Shankaracharya. So Ramanuja then described that the Lord has beautiful eyes like the petals of a lotus flower. And he described his lotus feet and his beautiful qualities and his transcendental form, full of eternity, knowledge and bliss. And Yadava Prakash, he was dumbfounded. He couldn't refute Ramanuja's brilliant explanation of the verse, but he became very upset because he could see that this boy is very dangerous, because actually he is completely threatening to undermine the whole teachings of the Shankara school, the Mayavad school. So several incidents happened like this, and Yadava Prakash decided that actually Ramanuja was too dangerous. He discussed it with some of his senior students, and he decided that actually Ramanuja is so dangerous because if he stays, he will undermine everything in the school. He will destroy Shankaracharya's philosophy. And if he leaves, he'll start his own school. And that will also smash Shankaracharya's philosophy. So therefore there is only one solution, and that is that Ramanuja must die. So the guru is planning how to kill him. His senior disciples agreed with him. Yes, he must die. So they went on yatra. They went on a pilgrimage to the forest. And the plan was that while Ramanuja was there, they would actually gang up on him and kill him, and then tell everyone that actually he'd been attacked by a wild animal and killed. But Govinda, who was also the cousin brother of Ramanuja, he overheard them all plotting like this, and he came and told Ramanuja, he said, you must get out of here immediately, because they're all going to kill you. So Ramanuja, he ran, and he ran away from the whole forest, and he got lost. He got hopelessly lost. But somehow or other, he was discovered by one couple in the dress of hunters who gave him shelter, and he served them very nicely, and they took him even very mystically back to Kanchipura, which is the city where Ramanuja was living. And the Shastras explain that actually this hunter couple were none other than Lakshmi Narayan. They had come in the dress of hunters in order to give protection to their devotee. So many, many incidents happened. It later happened, very late on in life, a couple of years before Yadava Prakash, because actually Yadava Prakash, he was a very, very well known as a great, not only a great orator, but a great performer of mystic powers, and he was known as a great exorcist. And it happened that the king's daughter, the princess, she had been possessed of a very powerful ghost. And this princess, she was so possessed, she was just completely impossible to communicate with. So the king called for Yadava Prakash to come and do his exorcism. So he's there and he's chanting his mantras, and through the body of the princess, the ghost just laughed and says, Yadava Prakash, you are a fool. You cannot do anything. You have no power. You cannot get rid of me. Only someone with much greater power than you can actually get me out of this princess's body. And so Yadava Prakash, he's furiously chanting higher and higher level mantras to try and get rid of this ghost, this Rakshasa ghost who's inside the princess's body. And then the ghost through the body of the princess laughed and said, no, you are so impure. Only someone who is very pure, your disciple, Ramanuja, he can get me out, not you. And this is right there in front of the king. So this is a very difficult situation for Yadava Prakash, because he's been told that he's useless, but your disciple is very pure and he's got much more potency than you. So he was obliged to call for Ramanuja. So Ramanuja, this young boy, and here's this very old man, Yadava Prakash, Ramanuja, he came and just started chanting very calmly some nice mantras. And through the body of the princess, the ghost said, "That's okay, I accept. You are completely pure. I actually want to take the dust from your feet. And I want, in fact, that I will go when you very kindly put your feet on my head. Then at that point, I will leave the princess's body." And then Ramanuja asked, "How will we know that you have left the princess's body?" So the ghost, through the body of the princess, said, "This big mango tree, the topmost big branch, as soon as I leave, I will break that big branch and it will fall from the tree." So the ghost inside the princess's body caused the princess to bow down at Ramanuja's feet. And Ramanuja put his feet on the head of the princess. And then immediately, this big crack! And this giant branch on top of this huge mango tree crashed and came tumbling down to the ground. And so this was a very wonderful incident for everyone to see in Kanchipuram. Just what is the wonderful prowess of this young boy, Ramanuja, who was already becoming very famous and very well known. So after this, actually, Yadava Prakash, he kicked out Ramanuja out of his ashram. He said, "You cannot stay here." There was some really big bust-up. And he decided he just could not tolerate him being in his ashram. But it did turn out later that a couple of years before Yadava Prakash's death, that he became very concerned that this Ramanuja, he was so powerful and so well-known, so many disciples, so many followers, so pure, so elevated, that he asked this one devotee called Kanchipuram, who was very well known, to speak to Varadraji, who is the deity in the Kanchipuram temple, the Vishnu deity there. And it was well known, if anybody wanted to know what was the deity's instruction, they would ask Kanchipuram, Kanchipurna. Because everyone knew that he would regularly, during his daily service of fanning the deity, because it was very hot. If you've been to Kanchipuram, you know that it's a very hot place. And his service was always to fan the deity with this small fan dipped in water to make a very nice cooling effect for the deity. And he would regularly have conversations with the deity. And everyone knew that if anybody was speaking to the deity, it was Kanchipuram. So, Yadava Prakash, he requested him, that what should I do? He asked Kanchipurna, "You please ask Varadraj, the deity, you please ask him, what should I do about Ramanujacharya?" So while Kanchipurna was fanning Varadraj, she said, "Yadava Prakash has made the request, he wants to know what he should do." So Varadraj replied, "You tell him that he should surrender wholeheartedly unto the lotus feet of Ramanuja and become his disciple." So this was very tough. But his heart, when he was given this message, he couldn't handle it and he couldn't accept it, but his heart did become softened. And so, just to conclude, because we're running short of time, he couldn't actually physically bring himself to do this. But he said to Ramanuja, he said, "You know, I really want to talk to you about your philosophy because I'm really struggling to understand this, because my beloved Shankaracharya, he's given us this understanding and I cannot go against this. But at the same time, I see that you are so pure and so advanced that I cannot reconcile the two things. So Ramanuja said, you should talk to my disciple Kuresh. Kuresh, there are many stories we could speak for hours about Kuresh.
Beautiful stories,
the most wonderful, extraordinary, saintly devotee. But Ramanuja told him, you speak with Kuresh and he will explain everything to you. So Kuresh explained everything so perfectly to Yadava Prakash, the disciple of Ramanuja. And that Yadava Prakash, he admitted, I am defeated. I can no longer hold on to this Mayavadi idea. I want to become your disciple, Ramanuja. And he begged for initiation. And he took initiation from Ramanuja. And Ramanuja gave him some service to do. He said, you can write. Now you've got these beautiful realizations. Now you can write books. So he wrote two very, very beautiful books in the 2 years before he left. Very valuable, very wonderful Vaishnava literatures. Although he was the arch Mayavadi. And Ramanujacharya, he gave him sannyas. And 2 years later he left this world. But he left a very good contribution behind. But Ramanujacharya, he was a very wonderful, powerful preacher. And he did so much, actually, to kick out the Buddhists, the atheists, and the Mayavadis out of India and return India back to Vaishnavism. So Sripad Ramanujacharya ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Nitai Gaura Premanandi Hari Gaura. Any questions or comments?
Thank you for the story.
Okay, there's so much we could say.
So many advanced
maybe next week.
There's so much to say about these extraordinary Vaishnavas. But Ramanujacharya, he particularly taught, there are so many things, but he particularly taught that one should have great faith in the devotional service to the Lord. One should serve the pure devotees and all the devotees of Krishna. And by this means, one gets the blessings of Krishna. Service to the Guru and the Vaishnava. And pure, unalloyed devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this we can take great benefit from his wonderful teachings. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Nitai Gaura Premanandi. Namah Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutalaya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityananda Namaste Saraswati Deva Gauravani Pachari Nirvishesha Samyavadi Upasthitaraya Shatara.